See if I'm on here now. There we go. We're continuing in the book of Job. So if you turn to Job chapter 34, we're getting close. We're getting real close. I just want to let you know, this morning we're going to read a lot of Scripture. I'll read it to you. I read from a translation called the Christian Standard Translation. Some of you have asked, don't feel like you have to have the same one I do. It's sort of nice for you to have your translation and then listen as I read mine. Mine's a fairly literal translation, and I like it because I understand it a little clearer, but I invite you just to listen as we continue on. Before we get into our text today, I want to tell you about an incident that took place at Princeton Theological Seminary years ago. A former student of Robert D. Wilson, one of the great professors there at that seminary, was invited to preach at Miller Chapel 12 years after he had graduated. And Dr. Wilson, his old professor, came into the chapel, sat down near the front. At the close of the meeting, the old professor came up to his former student. He cocked his head to one side, as he characteristically did. He extended his hand and he said, "If you come back again, I will not come to hear you preach. I only come once. I'm glad that you are a big godder. When my boys come back, I come to see if they are big godders or little godders. And then I know what their ministry will be." The student didn't understand. He says, "Please explain." And the old professor replied, "Well, some people have a little God, and they're always in trouble with him. He can't do any miracles. He can't take care of the inspiration and transmission of the Scriptures to us. He doesn't intervene on behalf of his people. They have a little God, and I call them little godders. Then there are those who have a great God. He speaks, and it is done. He commands, and it stands fast. He knows how to show himself strong on behalf of those who fear him. You have a great God, and he will bless your ministry." And he paused for a moment and smiled and said, "God bless you," and turned and walked out. Well, we are reading. We were introduced last week in chapter 32 to a new character in the book of Job. His name is Elihu. Elihu was a big godder. He had a very high, what we'll call, transcendent view of God, a knowledge of God that towered over man. And consequently, after he had been listening to the dialogue for 31 chapters between Job and his three friends, finally he speaks and he gives his counsel to Job. And he speaks from this perspective of a great God. And while Job's suffering may have been greater than Job was, in Elihu's estimation, God was even greater than his suffering. And as a result, Elihu sought to put everything in right perspective. And that's what we're going to listen to this morning, is Elihu's perspective on who God is. Because the kind of dialogue that's been taking place and where they're at now, the view of God is pretty little. It stinks, as a matter of fact. And so now he's going to show forth a big view of God. Here in chapter 34 is Elihu's second speech. It's a rebuttal of Job's contention that God is unfair. As Job looked at life, he concluded that there's no profit in loving and obeying God. "Look at what it's brought me," he says. "It's only brought me suffering and heartache." And so Elihu is going to address that. He invites Job and his three friends to listen now to his argument, to in essence, set aside the perspective that they've been wallowing in and listen to a new perspective, to listen to God's perspective. Verse 1 of chapter 34. Then Elihu continued saying, "Hear my words, you wise men, and listen to me, you knowledgeable ones." A little sarcasm there. "Doesn't the ear test words as the palate tastes food? Let us judge for ourselves what is right. Let us decide together what is good." And now he's going to quote what Job has said about God. verse 5. For Job has declared, I am righteous, yet God has deprived me of justice. God's not fair. Would I lie about my case? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. What man is like Job? He drinks derision like water. He keeps company with evildoers and walks with wicked men. For he has said, a man gains nothing when he becomes God's friend. Job has contended all along that he's righteous. But he's been wounded incurably, even though he knows he's without sin. What profit is there in serving God if suffering is the reward? It's a legitimate question from Job's perspective. But it lost sight of who God really was. Job claims that God has sentenced an innocent man. He's viewing his suffering as punishment, which is what his friends have been drilling into his mind all along. At this point, Job is dangerously close to buying into Satan's lies. The devil had said, if you remember back all the way back in chapters 1 and 2, the devil had said that Job wouldn't worship God if he took away Job's material prosperity. Job is almost to that point. He's almost ready to throw in the towel. Why bother worshiping God if this is all that it brings me? And Elihu now will rebut Job. He states that God cannot be unjust. He's always true to his character. God always acts in accordance with his nature. And so Elihu's going to give us some theology. He's going to talk about who God is. He's going to get out of the circumstances and into the heavenlies that shine light on what our circumstances are. Look at verse 10. Therefore, listen to me, you men of understanding. It is impossible for God to do wrong and for the Almighty to act unjustly. For he repays a person according to his deeds, and he brings his way on him. Indeed, it is true that God does not act wickedly, and the Almighty does not pervert justice. In other words, God will judge the wicked no matter how long it might take. He may not settle his accounts immediately, but one day he'll deal with the wicked. There will be a payday someday. God will one day give the unrighteous what they deserve. And then Elihu contended that God is beyond accountability to anyone. He is the sovereign authority over all the universe, and therefore he's not answerable to us. Verse 13, who gave him authority over the earth? Who put him in charge of the entire world? If he put his mind to it and withdrew the spirit and breath he gave, every living thing would perish together and mankind would return to the dust. You see, Job's been bellyaching. We heard about it last week as well. He's been saying, where is God? Where is God? And Elihu's saying, God is here. If God were to withdraw himself even for one second from our lives, we would all perish. God alone has the power to continue or to withdraw life. Next, Elihu declares that God is the impartial ruler of the universe. He's just throwing lots of, not just information, but divine truth that can make a difference in how we feel about life. He says that God judges mighty kings and he judges the wealthy, but he does so without partiality. Verse 16, if you have understanding, hear this. Listen to what I have to say. Could one who hates justice govern the world? Will you condemn the mighty, righteous one who says to a king, worthless man, and to nobles, wicked men? God is not partial to princes and does not favor the rich over the poor. For they are all the work of his hands. You know, Job's friends have been saying for so many chapters how, you know, when God takes away your riches, that's punishment. You're poor now because you're no good. You're hiding your sin. And here Elihu declares that God doesn't look at riches. not an issue of being rich or poor. Verse 20 says, they die suddenly in the middle of the night. People shudder, then pass away. Even the mighty are removed without effort. God is over all people. He's the sovereign authority. Men are partial. Men play favorites, but God doesn't. Men flatter kings to keep them happy, but God will judge a king when he's wrong. God has the power to judge a king whom men tremble before. Then Elihu extols God as the omniscient judge who sees the steps of man. God need not investigate a case before he judges it, because he sees everything. 21, for his eyes watch over a man's ways, and he observes all his steps. There is no darkness, no deep darkness where evildoers can hide themselves. God does not need to examine a person further, that one should approach him in court. He shatters the mighty without an investigation and sets others in their place. That's called pure justice. He does what is right. Nothing escapes his all-seeing eyes. He sees the heart. He understands man's ways. And don't think just because God has not yet judged the wicked that he's blind to their iniquity. No, in reality, God sees everything. He sees all their sins. 25. Therefore, he recognizes their deeds and overthrows them by night, and they are crushed. In full view of public, he strikes them for their wickedness because they turned aside and from following him and did not understand any of his ways, but caused the poor to cry out to him. He has heard the outcry of the afflicted. But when God is silent, who can declare him guilty? When he hides his face, who can see him? Yet he watches over both individuals and nations so that godless men should not rule or ensnare the people. Finally, what he's arguing is that God is the absolute executor of the universe. He'll overthrow the wicked when they least suspect it, whether at night when they can't see or in public when it's broad daylight. God will eventually strike down judgment on those who disobey him. So stop pointing the finger at each other. God is the CEO of the galaxy. If God chooses to remain silent and not explain what he's doing, who can charge God with wrongdoing? Just because he hasn't explained his actions to us doesn't mean that he doesn't have his reasons. Job, just because you don't know why what's going on is going on doesn't mean that God's not involved. Job may ask God why he's suffering, but he may not ask God to act as he thinks he should. Look at verse 31. Suppose someone says to God, I have endured my punishment. I will no longer act wickedly. Teach me what I cannot see if I have done wrong. I won't do it again. Should God repay you on your terms when you have rejected his? You must choose, not I. So declare what you know. In other words, what's going on here is demanding that God himself explain what's happening to Job is really crossing the lines. He may ask God to reveal his sin, but he can't demand an explanation, as if God were accountable to him. God, come on, down to my level, God, and explain it, you know, to me, because this is what I think's right, and I want you to do what I think's right. That's going too far. In conclusion, Elihu quotes Job's three friends, who have said that Job speaks without understanding. Reasonable men, verse 34, will say to me, along with the wise men who hear me, Job speaks without knowledge. His words are without insight. If only Job were tested to the limit, because his answers are like those of wicked men. For he adds rebellion to his sin. He scornfully claps in our presence while multiplying his words against God. They feel like Job should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law for speaking like a wicked man. They say Job has added a rebellious attitude to whatever sin he's first committed to get himself into this mess. Well, such is the reality of life. We suffer and become discouraged. When we do that, we lose sight of who God is. When life seems unfair, it causes us to question God's goodness. But Elihu is declaring God is fair. He's always fair. God does. He rewards us for our pain. His reward may come in this lifetime or it may come in the final day. We have to remember we're not home yet. We have to remember God's the one who's sovereign and in control. He's the one who makes the rules. He's the one who is mighty. He is not silent. He is not unjust. Yeah, but it seems like he is. He doesn't seem to care. That's what Job has really been saying. God just doesn't seem to care. Howard Hendricks, distinguished professor at Dallas Theological Seminary years ago, one of my favorite speakers and writers, he tells a story of when he was a young single man. He was aware that certain mothers had set their mind on him on behalf of their daughters. One mother said to him one day, "Howard, I just want you to know that I am praying that you will be my son-in-law." At that point, Dr. Hendricks stopped and asked, tongue-in-cheek, "Have you ever thanked God for unanswered prayer?" Well, at this point in the life of Job, unanswered prayer had been anything but a blessing. The lack of response from heaven, despite his many pleas, had been such a heavy burden for Job to bear. He repeatedly implored God for a change in his circumstances, but there had been no relief. It seemed as though there was only silence. And this lack of response from God led Job to conclude that God was indifferent or uncaring towards him. And so Elihu now begins his third speech in chapter 35 and declares to Job that God is not distant in our suffering. No, God is right here with us in our pain. Once again, Elihu begins by quoting Job. He's certainly been listening to what Job was saying. Then Elihu continued saying, "Do you think it is just when you say, 'I am righteous before God'? For you ask, 'What does it profit you? And what benefit comes to me if I do not sin?'" Elihu restates Job's contention that he's not only living righteously, but that it profits him nothing. It appears there's no reward for the righteous. Elihu now will correct Job and his friend's misunderstanding about God. Verse 4, "I will answer you and your friends with you. Look to the heavens and see. Gaze at the clouds high above you. If you sin, how does it affect God? If you multiply your transgressions, what does it do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give him? Or what does he receive from your hand? Your wickedness affects a person like yourself, and your righteousness another human being." Elihu points to the clouds that are overhead. He says, "Do you see how those clouds are floating above you? They're out of your reach. So is God. He's far above you. He's beyond your grasp. God said through Isaiah the prophet, 'For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts.'" This needs to remind Job and his friends who they really are. Whether man sins or whether man is righteous, God's not affected by man's actions. He's above that. God exists above our lives. But our actions do affect us. Our actions do affect our fellow man. And those things are important to God. But that's what verse 8 is really saying. Your wickedness affects a person like yourself. But they won't change God. Now Elihu moves into the main point of his third speech. God is not distant when we suffer. He's with us. Look at verse 9. People cry out because of severe oppression. They shout for help from the arm of the mighty. But no one asks, where is God, my Maker, who provides us with songs in the night, who gives us more understanding than the animals of the earth, and makes us wiser than the birds of the sky? When we are suffering, we cry out to God for help. At such a time, Elihu says, no one can say, God's not there for me. No one can say, where is God, my Maker? Because God will never leave us. That's not part of who He is. That's not His character. In our darkest hour, God's presence gives us what He calls a song in the night. He gives us His peace and His comfort, which is greater than our pain and our suffering. In our time of greatest need, God is here with us. We just need to recognize it. God doesn't change. We change, but He doesn't change. Maybe you're at that place right now in your life. Maybe you want things to work out in a particular area. Maybe you want your relationship with your spouse to work out. Maybe you want your career to work out. Maybe you want your child's life to work out. And while you're waiting, remember that God is there with you. He gives His peace. He gives His comfort. We simply need to wait on Him, to recognize Him, to stop being jostled about by the circumstances and hassles of life, and listen for His voice. You all know the poem, familiar poem. I bet some of you have it on your refrigerator, about a man's dream where he has a vision walking through life on a sandy beach with Jesus by his side. You know the poem I'm talking about? How many know the poem? Let me see your hands. Oh, you all do. Okay, yeah. I'm not going to read it. He looks back at the footprints, remember, in the sand, and he notices that at those troublesome spots in life, there's only one set of footprints that are marked in the sand. And the man asked Jesus where he's been during those troublesome times. And Jesus replies, that single set of footprints is mine. That's when I was carrying you and your burden. It's a good picture. Elihu continues his discourse addressing the issue that God is very present. But he also talks about whose prayer does God answer? Whose prayer does God not answer? There's some issues going on here. Look at verse 12. There they cry out, but He does not answer. Because of the pride of evil men. Indeed, God does not listen to empty cries, and the Almighty does not take note of it. Wow, that's a powerful verse. The only time God does not answer is when our hearts are proud and lifted up. Catch that? It's not until we come to the end of ourselves and cry out to God in faith. God doesn't answer the proud. Because when we're proud, we're saying we're the sovereign of the universe. We're in control. Do it my way. Explain to me why. Look at verse 14. How much less when you complain that you do not see Him, that your case is before Him, and you are waiting for Him. But now, because God's anger does not punish, and He does not pay attention to His transgression, Job opens his mouth in vain and multiplies words without knowledge. What he's saying there is Job is, all of his cries are rooted in pride and a demanding spirit. And because of that, he would not be heard by God. When your case is before Him in prayer, Elihu counseled, you must wait for Him to act in His own time. God won't be hurried by your impatient demands. He says, Job, wait on God. He really does hear you. He's reaching out to you. He'll give you songs in the night. Just wait on His perfect timing. Just pay attention. There's another poem involving sand that may reflect what Job deserves to receive. I doubt you have this one on your fridge. One night I had a wondrous dream. One set of footprints there was seen, the footprints of my precious Lord, but mine were not along the shore. But then some stranger prince appeared, and I asked the Lord, what have we here? Those prints are large and round and neat, but Lord, they are too big for feet. My child, he said in somber tones, for miles I carried you alone. I challenged you to walk in faith, but you refused and made me wait. You disobeyed, you would not grow. The walk of faith you would not know. So I got tired, I got fed up, and there I dropped you on your butt. Because in life there comes a time when one must fight and one must climb, when one must rise and take a stand or leave their butt prints in the sand. Bad pastor, bad pastor. Okay, yeah, you know, the good thing is, the good news is, God doesn't drop us on our butt. I mean, when it's all said and done, He doesn't treat us that way. That's verse 15. God's anger does not punish when our hearts are His, when we're His children. He cares for us. We just need to pay attention. We've seen the first three pieces of the puzzle. God's not silent. He's not unjust. He's not distant. And now there's a fourth that Elihu's going to talk about, and that is God is not powerless. In Elihu's fourth and final speech, he extols God's power in creation. God is not impotent. He's mighty. He's ruling the universe. Nothing is out of His control. Look at chapter 36. Then Elihu continued saying, "Be patient with me a little longer, and I will inform you, for there is still more to be said on God's behalf. I will get my knowledge from afar and ascribe righteousness to my Maker, for my arguments are without flaw. One who has perfect knowledge is with you." He claims to be speaking God's authority. And he first declares that God is almighty and powerful. Verse 5, "Yes, God is mighty, but He despises no one. He understands all things. He does not keep the wicked alive, but He gives justice to the afflicted. He does not remove His gaze from the righteous, but He sets them forever with enthroned kings. And they are exalted. If people are bound with chains and trapped by the cords of affliction, God tells them what they have done and how arrogantly they have transgressed. He opens their ears to correction and insists they repent from iniquity." Even when we blow it, there's a way out. And God's the one who provides that. God is powerful to judge the wicked, but He's also powerful to help the afflicted. And He doesn't misuse His power. He uses His power to reward the righteous and to punish sinners. Verse 11, "If they serve Him obediently, they will end their days in prosperity and their years in happiness. But if they do not obey, they will cross the river of death and die without knowledge." Two responses to suffering for righteousness. Either obey God's word and enjoy prosperity, or disobey and perish. Look at verse 13. "Those who have a godless heart harbor anger. Even when God binds them, they do not cry for help. They die in their youth, and their life ends among male cult prostitutes. God rescues the afflicted by afflicting them." That's an interesting statement, isn't it? "He instructs them by means of their torment." Maybe that's part of what's going on with Job. "Indeed, He lured you," verse 16, "from the jaws of distress to a spacious and unconfined place. Your table was spread with choice food." When the godless perish, it's not for lack of power on God's part. He's able to save them. Rather, it's because they refuse to yield to God and to cry out to Him for help. But God powerfully delivers the godly because they hear and they respond to the voice of God even in their suffering. Verse 17, "Yet now you are obsessed with the judgment due the wicked. Judgment and justice have seized you. Be careful that no one lures you with riches. Do not let a large ransom lead you astray. Can your wealth or all your physical exertion keep you from distress? Do not long for the night when nations will disappear from their places. Be careful that you do not turn to iniquity, for that is why you have been tested by affliction." Look, God shows Himself exalted by His power. Who is a teacher like Him? Who has appointed His way for Him? And who has declared, "You have done wrong"? Elihu now applies this teaching about God's power to Job. these verses are a strong warning to Job not to forsake God's way, not to turn to evil. He should be careful to not sin by complaining. Verse 24. Remember that you should praise His work, which people have sung about. All mankind has seen it. People have looked at it from a distance. Look, God is exalted beyond our knowledge. The number of His years cannot be counted. Elihu tells Job he should praise God for His great works. He should magnify God's name, not criticize Him. Exalt Him. And then Elihu describes God's great power as seen around him in an autumn storm. Verse 27, for He makes water drops evaporate. They distill the rain into its mist, which the clouds pour out and shower abundantly on mankind. Can anyone understand how the clouds spread out or how the thunder roars from God's pavilion? Look, He spreads His lightning around Him and covers the depths of the sea. For He judges the nations with these. He gives food in abundance. He covers His hands with lightning and commands it to hit its mark. The thunder declares His presence. The cattle also, the approaching storm. God's mighty power is seen in the evaporation and in the rain, in the clouds and in the thunder, in the lightning and the flooding sea. All of these works display God's power, His greatness. And He uses this for both blessing and punishment. Elihu says, Job, you need to see that God is in absolute control of the universe. God sovereignly reigns on His throne. And he then gives a graphic description of an electrical storm. It's possible, I don't know. It's just possible that maybe in the background there was some thunder. And it was starting to break out, and Elihu is speaking to Job, and he uses this as an example of God's mighty power. What an object lesson to look around us in the world, at the circumstances of life, at the circumstances of nature, and to see God in it. And that's what he does in chapter 37. Just listen as I read. My heart pounds at this and leaps from my chest. Just listen to His thunderous voice and to the rumbling that comes from His mouth. He lets it loose beneath the entire sky, His lightning to the ends of the earth. And there comes a roaring sound. God thunders with a majestic voice. He does not restrain the lightning when His rumbling voice is heard. God thunders marvelously with His voice. He does great things that we cannot comprehend. For He says to the snow, fall to the earth. And the torrential rains, His mighty torrential rains, serve as His signature to all mankind, so that all men may know His works. The wild animals enter their lairs and stay in their dens. The windstorm comes from its chamber, and the cold from the driving north winds. Ice is formed by the breath of God, and watery expanses are frozen. He saturates clouds with moisture. He scatters His lightning through them. They swirl about, turning round and round at His direction, accomplishing everything He commands them over the surface of the inhabited world. He causes this to happen for punishment for His land or for His faithful love. Listen to this, Job. Stop and consider God's wonders. Do you know how God directs His clouds or makes their lightning flash? Do you understand how the clouds float, those wonderful works of Him who has perfect knowledge? You whose clothes get hot when the south wind brings calm to the land, can you help God spread out the skies as hard as a cast metal mirror? Teach us what we should say to Him. We cannot prepare our case because of our darkness. Should He be told that I want to speak? Can a man speak when he is confused? Now men cannot even look at the sun when it is in the skies, after a wind has swept through and cleared them away, yet out of the north He comes shrouded in a golden glow. Awesome majesty surrounds Him. The Almighty. We cannot reach Him. He is exalted in power. In His justice and righteousness, He will not oppress. Therefore men fear him. He does not look favorably on any who are wise in heart. What a picture. Elihu says, Job, trust that God is right in your life. Don't pretend that you have all the answers. Don't demand that God explain himself to you. He's bigger than you. He's God, and you're not. And if you become proud, God will disregard you. Instead, fear God. Hold him in reverential awe. God will honor and make it right. That's what he's saying. You see the four truths that Elihu has said to Job? He said that God restores us with our suffering. He rewards us for our suffering. He reaches out to us in our suffering. And God reigns over us, even in our suffering. Elihu brings to Job a totally different perspective on his sufferings. Job's friends had told him that he's suffering because he's committed some grievous sin in his life. Elihu says, that's not the case. It's not how God is. It's not because you have sinned. It's in order to keep you from sinning further. To draw you closer to your God. To teach you how God is sovereign and in control of the affairs of your life. And to show you that God can reward you for righteousness. It all depends on whether you're a big Godder or a little Godder. If you've been listening to Job's friends, they're little Godders. You're more powerful because your sin brings all these bad things on you. No. Elihu says, God is bigger than that. And he's using it to teach you, to mold you, to draw you, to protect you. And instead of looking at the circumstance, you need to look at the God who's much, much bigger. And trust that in the midst of the storm, in the midst of the hassles, in the midst of the sufferings and afflictions, and they're very real. He's not denying their reality. But in the midst of those, God is still bigger. And he's still in control. And he still wants you to put your faith and trust and rest in him. Let's pray.